Pseudopod, episode 164, October 16th, 2009. This week's story, Linda's Appointment by Mike Norris. Hello, welcome to Pseudopod Towers, enter freely and of your own will. I'm Alistair, your host, and this week's story comes to us from Mike Norris. Mike is a member of the HWA, as well as the Sun and Foe Writer Circle, and has been published in Withersyn, The Wrong World DVD Collections, Grain Harvest, and Here, amongst others. His next piece is scheduled for TM Wright's Holy Horrors anthology, due out later this year. Mike also won 5th place in the annual short story contest, run by Cheezine and Leisure Books. He has 2 novels on the way, Devouring Grimace Price and The Dread Alba Cuckoo, both a horror. Mike mentioned to us that the story was inspired by the feeling of being an outsider to your loved one's experience that he felt in the run-up to his first child. He says, "The physical changes my wife underwent and the regular doctor's appointments that we attended together propagate a new level of intimacy. But at the same time, pregnancy is perhaps the most ultra-personal experience of womanhood. Although the door remains open to the husband, there was, within me at least, a strange sense of alienation. That feeling of being an outsider to your loved one's experience is what inspired this story." Your narrator this week is Kyan Chris Conroy of TechDiff.com. So wake up and listen to the sounds of what passes for normal, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Linda's Appointment by Mike Norris. Mud. Tons of it. And it wasn't just covering the pickup, it was everywhere. An obscene trail was spewed around the cul-de-sac. Every lawn and mailbox and driveway was splattered with river-bottom muck. It looked as if she'd smoked her tires through the final turn, an act befitting a drunken teenager's disregard for neighborhood politics. But Linda was 42. Her mess terminated before the garage door, where their poor Tundra sat so utterly defiled that it appeared to have been devoured by Blondie's man from Mars, and shat from a great height upon their driveway. The neighbors must think they were insane. Lewis hoisted his steaming mug and slurped. A hit of the black stuff smoothed his ruffled feathers on those mornings after Linda's appointments and provided a morale boost of around 5%. Not much, but that was sufficient to motivate him off the basement couch, to walk outside and to hose things down before the mid-morning sun baked his wife's mess into concrete, thereby lessening the chances that their neighbors would phone the cops again. But he wouldn't blame them if they did. He really wouldn't. Over the years, Lewis had adopted a rather acquiescent policy towards Linda's quarterly ordeal. Some level of detachment from his wife's obligation was a psychological imperative. The human mind wasn't designed to tolerate such indignities without something eventually going pop. Those Checkout Lane westerns he enjoyed reading on his basement couch always featured strong characters with names like Jeremiah and Jebediah. Men who never suffered much guff from those thundering hordes that like to smash down a poor sodbuster's cabin door. No self-respecting frontiersman would stand by while his wife was used by those invaders as if she were a public rest area along their highway to hell. Hell no. They'd never sit in their basements twiddling their thumbs until all the mayhem was over, content to help their ravaged wives tidy up once the marauders had finished their business, to scrub muddy boot prints off the sheets, tobacco spit and blood stains off the ruffled pillowcases. But Lewis didn't have a problem with submission. And that's the only reason his marriage to Linda had survived so long. Lewis closed his eyes and swallowed coffee, exhaling hotly through his nose. At least Linda's assailants never entered their home, and they almost certainly didn't chew tobacco. In point of fact, Lewis didn't know much of anything about them. When his eyelids parted, Linda's pickup was still sitting there, so festooned with bramble it barely resembled the shiny vehicle they'd purchased less than a year ago. It looked more like a guerrilla recon vehicle that had barely survived its last mission, and it probably wasn't going to clean itself off, nice as that might be. Out waddled Mr. Hanrahan, their grouse of a neighbor to the south. He was always the first to reach for the telephone and dial up some trouble. He shuffled the length of his driveway. There he hesitated, treating himself to a good, long stare at the tundra before shaking his head and muttering. He bent to retrieve his Sunday paper. Ah, but he grabbed the wrong end of the plastic sleeve. Monochromatic folds of newsprint extruded, flowered open, and took flight in the morning breeze. Hanrahan's lips formed curses as his hands snatched at sheets that flapped about his flabby form like great moths around a bulb. Lewis slurped his coffee. He didn't laugh. He never laughed anymore. He just studied the pandemonium through moist, vapid eyes, like one of the neighborhood cats perched upon their sills. Here a door opened, there curtains parted. It was 7:15 a.m. Soon they'd be sweeping their porches, casting furtive glances, crossing lawns to yammer and nod. And Lewis knew what they'd be yammering about. At half past the devil's hour, the cul-de-sac had stirred to the roar of a Toyota engine, to the sparks that sprayed from 20 feet of chain-link fence, all gnarled around Linda's axle as it dragged behind her like an unholy bridal train. What an awful reptilian hiss that mesh had rasped against the asphalt as she'd roasted her tires all around the circle, flinging mud and fat droplets. After 12 years of hearing the same old lies, none of the neighbors really believed she was out fishing anymore. Lewis sucked down the dregs and placed his empty mug on the counter. He sighed and rubbed his palms against his eyes. It was time to go outside. Time to do what he had to do. Passing the hall, he heard a sigh emanate through their locked bedroom door. That was a good sign. It was an indication Linda was still breathing, at least, and probably still able to speak. The morning after an appointment, she was always so sore, so exhausted. Often she'd sleep well into the afternoon. Sighs, coughs, little Linda noises. They were the beacons that guided Lewis through a haze of uncertainty that filled those hours before she'd allow him to view the balance of her attributes. Linda's appointments were just part of the deal. She'd made that clear before they ever tied the knot.
"They'll come for me," she'd told him, "from time to time."
But in those days, her little scars were just wonderful imperfections in Lewis's eyes. They made her no less a beauty to behold, and they made her attainable to an ordinary guy like him. She was like a floor piece appliance with a big scratch on one side, or a shiny apple with a bruise. Those little nicks didn't bother Lewis one bit. But just 8 days into their new marriage, what they took from Linda on the first night home from their honeymoon was somehow worse than a mastectomy. Just the cap of one areola remained, hewn into the angry cleft of an unleavened bun. Her assailants, as Lewis came to understand, weren't known for their surgical precision. And so soon after the wedding, they'd never taken so much of her before. And suddenly her life and their future seemed uncertain. Like her parents before him, Lewis learned that you handcuffed Linda to whatever household item you most wanted to see dragged out into the wilderness. If you wanted Linda to drag the armoire out into the swamp, then by all means shackle her to the damn thing. Be sure to lock her in whichever room you'd most like to see a Linda-sized hole in the drywall come morning, because make no mistake, she was going out. On the night she was summoned and sent her mental coordinates, there was no stopping her. Inevitably, Lewis broke the rules and tagged along. In her zombie-like torpor, Linda couldn't argue, even if she had spotted her husband sprawled in the bed of her pickup with a .357 revolver clenched in his hands. Dying together was just one spin on the many fantasies he'd entertained as he'd stared up into those black gulfs of stars en route to their secret rendezvous point. But he wasn't about to die until he made them pay for all they'd done to her. "This is for Linda's bottom lip," Lewis imagined squeezing the trigger. Bang! Turning one of its knees, if it had knees, into pulp. "This is for Linda's breasts." Bang! He'd blast another expendable appendage, ensuring that Earth would be the final rest stop in at least one invader's hellish highway. "And this..." He'd stride up like Clint Eastwood, close enough to inhale its otherworldly stink before discharging a round into its mouth. If it had a mouth. "Is for the baby." But his big showdown hadn't gone according to plan. He'd awoken with a splitting headache, nude and palpitating in a ditch 4 miles south of Melbourne, Australia. Yeah, it took quite a few days to sort things out at the American Embassy. Another cough. Lewis faltered. Was the shower running? Down the hall toward the master bedroom he walked, where roiling steam hung redolent with the scent of her green apple shampoo. Linda never showered with the bathroom door ajar. Not in as many years as he'd known her. Stranger still, she was humming. Linda never hummed. Lavender sweatpants were wadded in a bloody heap at the foot of the bed. Loose-fitting clothing was one of Lewis's helpful ideas. No drawstrings, just elastic, and of course some waterproof footwear. Lastly, he'd give her a liberal coating of bug spray, the deep woods variety, on her way out the door. It was the best he could do. Lewis always stocked her purse with plenty of gauze and antiseptic,
And in her passenger seat, he always left her a sack lunch and a couple of bottles of her favorite peach tea, because afterwards, she was always so thirsty. And he made sure to include a little note, assuring his wife of his unconditional love. What more could he do? Reaching for the shower curtain, he hesitated.
How very special are we?
He recognized Linda's tune as the swan song of a certain gray spider. Charlotte's Web was in fact the book she'd purchased in expectation of the only child her ruined womb would ever conceive. The little tenant who at 8.5 months was so forcefully evicted. She still kept the book on her nightstand.
How very special are we?
Her back was to him. Water droplets squirmed through the web of scar tissue that knotted her grafted buttocks and down her thighs, where a sanguine cascade flowed between her remaining toes, spinning a crimson vortex over the drain. Dear God, what have they done to her this time? His gaze explored the constellations of biopsy pox and roved over those mulberry patches where her blonde hair had long ceased to grow. And as she turned her hip, he caught a glimpse of that jagged abdominal grin, where they'd extracted her most precious thing of all. Her childlike tenor throttled Lewis's throat. Salty pools overflowed his eyes.
They're all done with me now,
Linda said, as if she'd been aware of his presence all along. Lewis stepped part way into the shower, reluctant to believe that which he'd heard, but fearful to touch his wife for any mutilation not yet apparent.
It's really over. Sweetheart, your appointments are all done?
Yes,
Linda whispered, fully turning to spill not tears of joy, but cherry streams from the empty cradles in her face, aborted of their wistful green eyes. Lewis gaped into those hollows as she pressed her remaining lip against his own in a toothy half-kiss.
But they said to tell you.
Linda rocked her husband side to side in a wet embrace.
That your first appointment is scheduled for Tuesday.
I have a special, unique, and genuine terror of alien abduction stories. When I was younger, and by younger I mean at least 20, it was a real and genuine terror of alien abduction. To be fair to me, the Isle of Man was fairly remote, and to be fair to me still, Yorkshire has its fair share of abduction stories, but for me, it all came down to one book, Intruders by Bud Hopkins. I remember buying it on a whim, flicking through it, getting to the photo inserts, including the pictures drawn by abductees of what they'd seen, and like flicking a switch, my hindbrain started yelling, you run like hell, or you throw the evil book in the fire. Do one of these now. So, of course, I hid it in a drawer, and read around the subject for a while, keeping one eye on that drawer at all times, you know, in case of sudden movements. Nowadays, my take is a little different, coloured by just over a decade of rationality, experience, and when necessary, sleeping with the lights on. Do I believe aliens exist? Of course I do. Do I think they come here and do unspeakable things to us? Of course I don't. If nothing else, because ufology, as a field of study, is so ridiculously and offensively muddled, be it through internal politics, outright lies, or the gap between perception and belief, that any chance of real answers has long since faded. Sort of like swamp gas. But the light from the campfire only reaches so far. And for every part of our brains that wants to stay near it, there's another that says, go a little further, take a look, see what's out there. It might be good. And something is. Something always will be. The only thing that changes is what we change it into. Grendel, the bogeyman, the unstoppable serial killer, the blank, implacable aliens who aren't quite feline and aren't quite human and are absolutely, fundamentally, skin-crawlingly wrong. We want desperately to run from them, but we can't, because they define us, whether as something to examine and understand and defeat, or something to cower from, to pray for deliverance from, or to. This, to answer a question very kindly put to me by a listener recently, is why the Mothman prophecies terrified me as profoundly as it did, and also why the first time I saw the trailer for The Fourth Kind, I felt the hairs rise on my neck and all the old information flood back in. Because regardless of whether or not you believe these stories, they're all about the same thing. That moment that comes just after we shine a light on the thing that waits in the dark. The moment where it turns and sees us. And suddenly we realize we are on the wrong side of the predator-prey equation. Nietzsche had it absolutely right. the Abyss does look back at you. And if you're supremely lucky, that's all it does. Whereas all I ever do is ask for your money. Well, that's not true. I beg for your money as well. Pseudopod relies on you to pay our authors, so if you like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. If you fancy catching up on previous episodes in a super swanky format, why not go to poddisc.com? Tell Matt I said hi. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Pseudopod will be here next week as we continue to walk through this broken land.